There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Hi, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 92, dated 5 May 2008. The guest on this show is Chuck DeVore, California State Assemblyman for the 70th District. Chuck has been working tirelessly for several years to convince the California State Legislature to overturn its virtual ban on new nuclear power plants. Hope you enjoy the interview. I've been looking over your website, and of course I've been following your efforts to get nuclear back on the discussion table in California, and really have been amazed by the frustrating experience of not being able to even get it out of committee.
Yeah, well, that's California politics. We, our politics in the legislature are perhaps a little more partisan than in other parts of the country. We have a huge state and gigantic districts and a professional legislature, and that probably causes there to be a little more partisan tension in our body than in other states where you've seen pro-nuclear legislation move along a little more, you know, with a bipartisan flavor. Mm-hmm. And I think that has a large part to do with it. And you combine that with the term limits out here, where you're really not in the legislature for that long, so you really can't develop a lot of friendships. Mm-hmm. 6 years in the Assembly, 8 years in the Senate is the limit that we have. And then throw into the mix the terribly gerrymandered districts that we have, that typically means for most of our districts that they're very much in one camp or the other. So there's not a lot of room for compromise. And we have a very strong Sierra Club here, a very strong environmental movement. But you're seeing some cracks develop. You know, I've had some support from the AFL-CIO Construction Trades Union. In fact, I'm going to be interviewing two prominent union officials tomorrow on my cable TV show. Mm-hmm. And I know that the fact that they're supporting my efforts has caused a fair amount of angst with the other side, because they don't like to you know, choose between either working class constituents or the Sierra Club in this case.
Well, I think that nuclear power is one area where the partisan divide just confuses me, because, I mean, it really is a humongous jobs program, which should get the people on the left who are interested in labor issues and those kinds of things at least interested. You know, it is clean energy that doesn't produce any emissions, so that should get people at least interested in thinking about it. You know, it is a program that traditionally there were a lot of people on the Democratic side who were very supportive of nuclear. Al Gore Sr. was a big pro-nuclear legislator at one time.
Well, you're right. The issue, though, is that when you look at California politics and you look at who controls the levers of power out here, it is kind of the traditional across-the-board, very liberal part of the Democrat Party out here in California. So that basically means, you know, the trial attorney constituency, the environmentalist constituency epitomized by the Sierra Club out here, the labor constituency, minority constituencies. Now, what you're seeing with nuclear power in California, though, is gradually you're seeing a realization among working class constituencies and labor that this makes a lot of sense. And among opinion leaders within the environmental community, those who have more of a scientific orientation are certainly becoming more pro-nuclear. But the political, the environmentalists who are purely in the political vein, you know, they're not about to switch. I think a lot of it just has to do with inertia. That's what they've always done. They don't want to reevaluate their positions at all. They don't want to look at the new facts. But I think the situation on the ground in California is going to change dramatically in the coming year, because we are once again facing a perfect storm like we did a few years back when rising energy costs and our partial electrical deregulation law both kind of combined to wreak havoc on California's electrical costs and our electrical supplies. A lot of experts think that we're going to see a doubling of the cost of natural gas here very soon. California is heavily dependent on natural gas for a number of decisions, some of which having to do with the desire for clean air. You know, apart from global greenhouse gas emissions, natural gas is a very clean fuel, other than the fact that it produces about 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions of coal, which is still unacceptably high for most people. So, because California relies on natural gas for about 42% of its electricity, and most experts think that the cost is going to double in the next year, you may see quite a bit of economic pain hit consumers and businesses in California in the coming year. And with that pain, you're going to see people take another look at these measures that have been passed in the last year to dramatically reduce the global greenhouse gas emissions that we make, to end the use of coal-fired power, and they're going to look at those, and they're going to either come to the determination that those rules, those mandates, need to be abolished or pushed back, or if you're serious about making those greenhouse gas reduction mandates, then you've got to allow nuclear power, because that's the only practical way that you can do it.
Have you been able to build any constituents or coalitions with some of the people in, say, Silicon Valley? Because, I mean, California does have a very technologically educated and involved group of people.
That has been slow in coming. We have reached out to them. They intellectually understand the need for this power. The problem is they have other crises that they're dealing with. We have a very high cost of electricity already in California. I believe we're the second highest in the country. These environmental rules and new labor rules and new regulations and taxes have all conspired together to cause a lot of these businesses to shift their manufacturing out of California to other states and other countries, and pretty much just leave the R&D portion here in the state. And so as their skin in the game, as it were, diminishes in California, their desire to change things and their ability to change things begins to diminish as well. I think that the whole nuclear power issue, a lot of these folks simply look at it as, well, you know, we'll get another state to host our nuclear power plant. Maybe we'll be able to build one in New Mexico or Utah or something, and just bring the power in from another state. I don't really think they see the crisis yet. There are plenty of other higher priorities that they're dealing with. And it's compounded by the fact that our publicly owned utilities out here constantly are singing the green game. They're saying, well, you know, we're increasing wind, we're increasing solar. And if they do talk about nuclear at all, it's only in the context of, well, you know, maybe we'll consider building an out-of-state because that's the path of least resistance. And what they're not bringing up, of course, is if you build a plant out-of-state, you don't get the tax base, you don't get the job space. The other state may charge significantly more, basically in terms of a political payoff, for California to site a nuclear plant out-of-state. And, of course, you can double the amount of electricity lost through line resistance over long distances, from the average of 6% to probably closer to 15%. And if you add all these factors together, including the tremendous cost to build the long-distance transmission lines, you're probably looking at doubling the cost of a facility, which, of course, manifests itself in higher rates for California ratepayers and businesses. So it really is not a smart idea for Californians to just think that, you know, well, we'll just give up as far as siting any additional modern nuclear power plants here in California, and we'll just ask Colorado or New Mexico to site them for us.
Yeah, because building a nuclear power plant certainly is going to require some certain political effort, obviously, as you've seen. But siting a 300 or 500 or 800 mile long power line is going to be very difficult in today's environment.
Well, it's even longer than that because we're talking about the West, where the distances are.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I'm an East Coast guy.
You know, I mean, 300 miles doesn't even get you out of the state. I mean, you know, you're looking at a 1,000-mile transmission line. And, you know, it's true. We do have long transmission lines, for example, to carry the hydropower from the Northwest down to California during the summer. But what Californians need to remember, lest they think that this is an easy thing to do, is the only reason why those power lines make sense, even with the line loss, is the fact that over the years, Washington State has had an abundance of hydropower during certain times of the year where its small population relative to California couldn't consume all that power from all that water coursing through the Columbia River and through the Grand Coulee Dam. So instead of just letting the water, you know, fall through on the other side of the dam, it makes sense to power up the turbines and ship the power to California, even though we're losing probably 6 or 7% more of that power through line loss than is typical. The problem with siting something like a nuclear power plant is, you know, why on earth would you want to site it 900 miles away if you know for a fact the power is going to be used in California? It just doesn't make sense.
Right. I mean, one of the advantages to nuclear that so far hasn't been taken advantage of as well as it should is that, I mean, nuclear is clean enough to be a pretty good neighbor, unlike a coal-fired power plant.
Well, and that's what I keep trying to tell people. I mean, I spoke to a synagogue yesterday about a number of issues, nuclear power among them, and I reminded the people there that if any of them had had a banana for breakfast, that the radiation in that one banana would more than equal the radiation that they would have gotten from living next to a nuclear power plant. And, of course, people were wondering if they should stop eating bananas, and I tried to explain it. Well, no. It's just that in today's modern era of very sensitive instrumentation, we can measure levels of radiation that were not possible to measure a number of years ago. And you have to understand that the entire world is radioactive. Everywhere you go, there's radioactivity, and the issue is how much. When you try to explain to people the tremendous amounts of radiation that are associated with burning coal, as I like to say, you're burning rocks, not to mention, of course, the carcinogenic effect of the chemicals and the small particulates in coal smoke, coal emissions. You know, cancer doesn't care if it was caused by a beta particle, an alpha particle, or some carcinogenic chemical that lodged deep within your lungs. The fact is that many of the carcinogens that are associated with coal emissions are far more potent than a few stray bits of radiation, assuming that anything ever leaked from a nuclear power plant, which, of course, we know that the leakage from the American and certainly the Western nuclear power industry is fractionally what it has been from, for example, the coal industry, and just a tiny fraction at that. So, you know, it's important for people to put things into perspective and to really understand what they're talking about here, as opposed to just kind of getting afraid of something that just because they don't understand it.
Yeah, and that's one of the areas where our regulatory bodies have been very poor at recognizing what the science says about radiation doses. I have been fighting for quite a while, and there's lots of people who are fighting more effectively than I am, this idea that all radiation is bad for you. The linear no threshold dose assumption is simply wrong, scientifically speaking.
Right. I've been seeing some body of evidence in recent years that would seem to suggest that a certain amount of background radiation is healthy for an organism to maintain proper health, perhaps along the lines of getting a modest amount of sunlight every now and then. So You know, unless you're prepared to live within a 9-foot-thick lead-walled room or something, then of course you'd have to worry about lead poisoning. But you know, the fact is that there are a number of risks that are associated with just living on this planet. Certainly, taking a car or a bus or a train or an aircraft each have their own associated risks. Living next to an oil refinery has an associated risk, not only from the emissions of that plant, but also from potential explosions or pipeline ruptures. Living near a natural gas pipeline has an associated risk. Dams occasionally rupture and inundate communities. As I recall, one of the more recent big hydroelectric dam failures occurred in India a few decades ago, in the 70s, I believe, and killed thousands of people. And, of course, we know that coal, in addition to the direct deaths caused by mining accidents, which are thankfully relatively few in the United States, but obviously very significant in places like China, we do know, though, that that burning coal probably causes about 30,000 Americans to die prematurely every year. And so you have to compare our uses of any source of energy with the alternatives, and you have to look at risk and reward. And one of the great things about nuclear power that I think people are beginning to wake up to is that, number one, you can reduce your reliance on imported fossil fuel from countries that don't like us. I mean, why are we importing oil and natural gas from countries where a fair amount of that money ends up going to fund terrorist operations to try to kill Americans? That's just stupid. It's not only bad energy policy, it's bad foreign policy, bad military policy, and we ought to do whatever we can to minimize it. And of course, the other great benefit of nuclear power is, based on every study that I've read so far, it appears to provide the highest amount of electricity for the lowest amount of end-to-end life cycle greenhouse gas emissions, better than wind, better than solar, potentially a lot better than hydropower. It depends on where the hydro dam is built. If it's in a dry or desert area, it probably isn't so bad. But if a hydro dam is built in an area where the reservoir ended up flooding an active forest, there's a growing body of evidence which seems to suggest that you actually put yourself further behind on a greenhouse gas equation because you've inundated the carbon impounding forest. So, you know, it seems to me that a growing body of evidence suggests that nuclear power is the solution to several of our problems today.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned gas pipeline explosions. One of the things that I like to talk about, because I don't think too many people put two and two together, but, you know, in August of 2000, there was a gas pipeline near a place called Carlsbad, New Mexico, that exploded. And that rupture, explosion, created a trench that was 60 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 20 feet deep. It also caused a fireball that killed 12 people who were fishing nearby. Of those 12 people, a couple of them died instantaneously, but the rest of them experienced a very slow, painful death from burning. Now, the other part of that effect was that that pipeline carried one-third of the natural gas going into California. And that pipeline was not repaired until about June of 2001. Now, being a California resident, what happened to California's energy prices between August of 2000 and June of 2001?
Well, they increased tremendously, not only because of that pipeline rupture, but also because of a poorly cobbled together partial energy deregulation, and also because of paralysis of our then Governor Gray Davis, where he refused to allow his appointees allow the energy companies to, specifically the electrical utilities, to negotiate long-term rates. All of those things together, combined with a budget deficit problem that we had then and are having again now, combined it to create the perfect storm, and actually led to the first recall of a governor in modern U.S. history. in 2003. So you could say that that pipeline rupture was directly part. Contributed to the fact that we now have Arnold Schwarzenegger as our governor.
Yeah, it was part of the perfect storm, and that and what a, and I'm glad you mentioned all the factors. What often happens is disasters aren't really disasters except for when you have two or three or four things all happening at the same time.
Right, it's the cascade effect, or as we used to say during my career in the U.S. Army, I retired last year as a lieutenant colonel, you want to give the enemy three ways to die. So a minefield, direct fire, and indirect fire, or airstrikes. You know, you can react to one, you can't react to two or three. And your analogy is precisely correct, that you know, whenever you're very tenuous at the margins with being able to bring in a supply of fuel, you may be able to react to one supply disruption, but when you start having more than one, you're in big trouble. And what I find rather frustrating and certainly ironic is that the same forces that are preventing in vocal opposition to nuclear power in California are the same people who are preventing the siting of two additional liquefied natural gas terminals that we need to meet the West Coast's needs. The one that was built was ironically built in Mexico near Tijuana because, of course, they wanted the jobs and there was less resistance environmentally in Mexico. So most of the gas that's brought in through Tijuana makes its way into the San Diego region. But most experts think that we need another two liquefied natural gas terminals on the West Coast to provide the needs of the West Coast, which are rapidly increasing, while at the same time, the natural gas fields of North America are in long-term decline. Now, it's true that we had a little one-year uptick in production, which most people think was an anomaly related to the increasing costs that natural gas is commanding on the market. But in long term, the natural gas fields in the Rocky Mountain states and in Canada are in decline. And as they go into decline, and as we use more natural gas, because we are using more, not less, then we have to make up the difference with supplies from places like Indonesia. And it just doesn't make sense that the only way you can economically move that natural gas across the Pacific Ocean to the West Coast is on a tanker with liquefied natural gas. You can't simply compress it. It's got to be liquefied. And you need special terminals to offload it. So the same folks that are blocking nuclear power are blocking liquefied natural gas terminals. And, oh, by the way, they're also increasingly blocking the construction of electrical transmission lines through the remote desert areas, often through national parks or through Forest Service land or Bureau of Land Management land, but they're blocking the construction of these transmission corridors that allow us to even get the electricity that we need from wind and solar. So they're, you know, they're fine with building wind and solar fields out in the middle of nowhere, but heaven help you if you try to build, you know, 150-mile transmission corridor to actually get it to where it's needed.
Well, if the forces are successful in preventing new nuclear plants and preventing imported liquefied natural gas, what happens to the price of domestic natural gas?
Well, certainly the price of domestic natural gas is going to continue to go up significantly, but because gas, like oil, is a fungible commodity, I can't imagine, other than a few spot shortages, that it's going to be that much more than the world price. You know, we do have ability to move it around within the country, and a lot of these electrical utilities do have long-term contracts for delivery. But over time, those prices will go up. I think the most interesting thing, though, is that in California, a lot of these plays against energy mirror plays against water. And, of course, as Mark Twain said, you know, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. So water is very important for growth and development out here in California. Water, by the way, consumes probably the most amount of electricity of any reason to turn turbines. Moving water is either number one or number two out here in California because it takes a tremendous amount of energy to ship water around our state. The people who are opposed to both electricity and to water have an ulterior motive, and that's to shut down growth and development in California. They don't want more people here. They think that the state is overpopulated as it is, and they would like to see less people living here. Now, the problem, of course, is that the average Californian does not share this vision. The average Californian wants to be able to pay their mortgage. They want to be able to raise their family, get their kids a good and decent education, and hope that perhaps someday they might see their own grandkids living somewhere near them in California. And so this vision of the average working class Californian, I think, stands in stark contrast with the vision of the elite leaders of the Sierra Club and other radical environmentalists in this state. And what I predict will happen in the near future is that as electrical costs begin to soar in the state of California, voters are going to start to look around for someone to blame. And you may see some pretty significant political upheaval out here because the people in power today did not act while they had the chance, did not do the things that they needed to do to secure our electrical grid and to ensure affordable electrical prices. You know, California is the most electrically efficient state in the country. Now, some of that is due to the fact that we have very benign weather, and some of that is due to the fact that we're very good at conservation. We're the third most energy efficient state in the country overall, you know, because we like to drive a lot in California. So we're not number one on overall energy, but we are on electricity. And so, you know, all of the low-hanging fruit for conservation was picked in California long ago. And many of the advocates of saying that we don't need any more you know, traditional sources of power, we can do it all with wind and solar, are people who somehow think that we can conserve our way to prosperity. And, you know, conservation is important. You need to do it. But if you look at electrical consumption trends in California, with all the additional people that are expected to move into the state, you cannot do it all with conservation alone. You've got to have additional capacity.
Did you know that there was a time when the Sierra Club was very important in a campaign called Adams, Not Dams?
Yes, I'm very well aware of that amazing irony, and I think perhaps they've been trying to atone for those sins ever since, and as a result they're very much and very vociferously against nuclear power. And, of course, they're against dams, too. You know, they've even sued to stop geothermal plants. I'm originally from a little town in the eastern High Sierra where we have when I'd moved out of the town, we had about a 50-megawatt geothermal station that the operators wanted to expand. And, of course, the Sierra Club sued them to stop the expansion. So, you know, I think the only remaining sources of power that are politically correct to them are wind and solar. And yet, wind kills an enormous number of raptors and bats. They've been spending millions upon millions of dollars to relocate the wind turbines in the Altamont Pass region southeast of the San Francisco Bay Area and to erect larger wind turbines that would probably spin more slowly. And the first results of an extensive study recently came in about a month ago, and they found that spending all those millions of dollars to try to move the wind turbines away from the bird migration routes and to erect larger turbines that spun more slowly had no effect on bird and bat mortality, none at all. There's you know, very important raptors that are important to maintaining the ecological balance of the region are getting killed wholesale there. And, of course, as we know, wind is a very periodic source of power and cannot be relied upon to power the grid in a modern society. In California, only has about 17% availability because of the wind patterns out here. It tends to maximize in the early morning and late at night when it's not really needed.
Yes, and I'm always amazed by people who assume that if you put turbines offshore that there's going to be wind out there. Having been a sailor and having studied the history of some very sophisticated sailing ships called clipper ships, which lost to very primitive coal-fired steamships, I just don't understand why people don't realize that the wind just doesn't blow that much.
Well, I think people erroneously think that you can bottle up the electricity and store it. And I do know that there are ways that you can store electricity, the most basic, of course, being that when you've got the power from wind, you take water and you pump it uphill behind a dam. The problem, of course, when you do that is you lose about half of the energy due to the inefficiencies in the system, and, of course, it renders you dependent on dams, which those same environmentalists don't much like. And when you lose 50% of the efficiency, of course, you're pushing up the per unit cost of wind power by a like amount. Now, the other challenge with wind power out here in California is that because we like to turn on our lights and actually have them turn on when we want them to, you have to back up wind power with gas turbine generators. And those gas turbine generators, when they're not being used, of course, you're still paying to maintain them. You're still paying to have them have personnel there to watch over them. And then as soon as the wind dies down, you've got to crank them up and kick them into operation. And then, of course, they're spewing greenhouse gas emissions, and they're consuming an increasingly expensive commodity, natural gas. And so if you understand that you can't have wind power without natural gas, you very quickly begin to understand that wind power is really not a very economical solution in many cases. Now, solar in California does appear to have some economic value, even probably without subsidies, especially as natural gas is getting more expensive, because solar does roughly approximate the peaking power demand during a hot day when we need that power to run air conditioning. So there is a relatively decent demand profile match between what society needs to power air conditioning and what solar thermal can do for you out in the desert. But again, you get back to the issues of transmission lines from the desert to the city where the power is needed. And you need to honestly take a look at what's happening out in the desert. I've visited the solar fields out at Cramer Junction. They produce, as I recall, about 135 watts of power. Their solar thermal fields have been up probably for about 20 years now.
Is that megawatts, you mean?
Yes. What did I say?
You said watts.
Oh, yes. 135.
That'd be about
135 megawatts, yes.
Yeah.
In other words, not very much, though.
Yeah.
And they cover about 1,000 acres or so. And what I was struck by when I went out to visit them was the fact that there was no plant or animal life whatsoever underneath those panels. The entire 1,000-acre area was a dead zone because the plants are a fire hazard for the parabolic trough mirrors, and they spray like an herbicide to keep the plants from growing and to keep the dust down, because the dust and sand ablates the mirrors and increases their maintenance costs. And so what I found somewhat interesting is that in that entire area, it was devoid of any life. Now, people who don't live in the desert may think, well, that's all well and good. There's no life out there anyway. But as a guy who spent a lot of time in the eastern High Sierra, I can tell you that there's a lot of life out there, including desert tortoises and various lizards and snakes and roadrunners and a lot of different things that live in the desert. And so how much of the desert are we willing to cover, because the energy density of solar power is so minimal compared to the energy density of something like nuclear power, where you can produce hundreds of times the amount of electricity on a much smaller imprint on the ground.
Yeah, one of the things that I try to get people to understand is the idea of capacity factor. And, of course, that sounds complicated to people. But I say, well, let me ask you, if you want to build a restaurant, would you like to have a restaurant where you can fill 90% of your tables 90% of the time, day, night, weekend, holidays, whatever? Or would you like to have a restaurant where I guarantee you that you have to close it every afternoon, you can't open until noon, and you can't fill your tables even when it's open? Which capital investment would you rather make?
Well, exactly, and that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize. You know, the Los Angeles Times has been among the worst in this. They keep editorializing in favor of wind and solar and against nuclear, and there's no amount of fact or data that you can give them to cause them to sway their mind. They were recently promoting a wind field out by I think it was in Kern County, that was supposed to have 4,000 megawatts of power. But what they, and they say, and this will supply X hundreds of thousands of homes. Well, what they fail to say, of course, is, yeah, when the wind is blowing, which in California would be 17% of the time that you need it. So nowhere in any of their editorials do they even mention that whatsoever, and that in order to rely on that, that 4,000 megawatts, you've got to build an entirely new transmission line corridor, and you have to have backup from natural gas plants ready to go at a second's notice when that wind dies down. The other thing that's interesting about the wind in California is that on really hot summer days that are often caused by a high pressure ridge over the area of Nevada and California, in that border region, what you often find is that in the high desert areas where they like to site the wind turbines, for example, on your way to Palm Springs, what you find is that, that the wind is calmed during those periods of very intense summer heat. It's still in that desert region. And as a result, those wind turbines don't do anything for us when many of these heat waves hit California. The last time that happened was in the summer of 2006, as I recall, where we had a four-day period of very high temperatures where all of those wind turbines out by Palm Springs were producing no power at all. Now, what's interesting about all those turbines at Palm Springs, and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them over about a 14,000-acre area, as I recall, is that when they are all working together, as I recall, they make less electricity than the two reactors at San Onofre. So here they are covering more surface area than all of America's, 104 reactors combined? Mm-hmm. All of those reactors could fit inside of the footprint of those thousands of wind turbines, and yet all of those wind turbines, when they're working at peak capacity together, produce less power than the one plant at San Onofre that has two reactors.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Now, going back a little bit to the effect on the price of natural gas of restricting other energy sources, I'm a little less sanguine about our ability to bring in liquefied natural gas from anywhere else. Right now, the U.S.'s LNG import capacity is probably about 4 to 5% of our total natural gas usage, because California is not the only place that has fought LNG terminals. LNG, right now, I think there's only 4 active sites in the U.S., and then there's that one just south of the U.S. in Mexico. So when other energy supplies are restricted, the price of natural gas goes up considerably.
Well, and it can go up very rapidly, too. California passed a bill at the same time it passed this global greenhouse gas reduction measure. And the bill basically says that we can no longer renew electrical contracts when the source of that electricity is traditional coal-fired power. Now, California internally only produces a very small fraction of its power from coal, but we import quite a bit from places like Utah. So that last year, about 16% of our electrical portfolio came from coal versus roughly 50% nationwide. The year before, it was about 20%. And it fluctuates up and down depending on how much hydropower is available and how hot the year is. So now we have this law that says you got to get rid of all coal-fired power in California. The contracts expire over a period of about 20 years. Well, how do you make up that power? Well, at the same time, the powers that be want to double our so-called renewable portfolio from 10% to 20%. In 2 years' time. It needs to be doubled by 2020. And there's actually a ballot initiative to double it again in a relatively short order. And what qualifies as renewable in this state, small hydro, wind, solar, geothermal, and biofuels, if you look at them, they're not easily scalable. They're generally expensive. And they really don't do anything to displace the natural gas that we have to burn. They pretty much, if we're lucky, can displace the coal that we have to get rid of. And you add to that that California, with 38 million people, is supposed to grow another 6 million to 44 million by 2020, you begin to see the scale of our problem. We're looking at a 20% growth in this state over a period that we have to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 25% and get rid of most of our coal-fired power. And if you begin to add up all the numbers, California is going to put more pressure on the nation's natural gas supply. You know, we're pushing more entities to burn natural gas as a fuel for vehicles. We're burning more of it for electricity. We use it to heat our water and water heaters. And I think you're right. I think we are probably staring at a pretty significant increase in natural gas costs, driven by demand and driven by energy policy that says that we have to get rid of coal, but doesn't tell you how to realistically replace it.
So you're a politician and a strategist, having served in the Army for 24 years. Do you see anybody besides environmentalists who might have a motivation for restricting energy supplies?
Well, you know, there are certainly interesting theories out there. I mean, I do like to follow the money. The problem is, of course, without a legal action and doing discovery and having, you know, an FBI investigation or something, it's very difficult to uncover who might be funding whom to help their own portfolio.
I didn't say who's funding. I said who might be benefiting. Who has the means, motive, and opportunity?
It's very clear to me that there are people who benefit from these actions. And clearly, even within the energy industry, domestically and foreign, you have a number of factors where you know, big coal is going to do what they can to defend their interests and see what we can do to move to clean coal, which I think, by the way, is pretty pie in the sky. I just don't see how that's going to work. I understand that they're doing it in Norway, and it's only impounding like one third of the carbon that it's supposed to. Clearly, other fossil fuel producers benefit from higher prices, but we should also understand that even as the energy companies are making record profits, it's not like you can actually eat the money. The money goes into more drilling, more exploration. Certainly it's paid out as dividends to the shareholders, and it wasn't long ago that oil companies were losing money, you know, when oil was at $13 a barrel. But clearly our foreign traders, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Iran, these countries are certainly making out like bandits with the high energy costs. And oh, let's not forget the large agribusiness interests like Archer Daniels Midland's with this incredibly stupid and asinine policy that we continue to pursue in America.
Don't hold back. Don't hold back, Chuck.
I mean, it. You know, people are literally starving to death around the world because of American corn ethanol policy. And, you know, I can't put it any more clearly than that. I mean, how stupid is it to have a policy that takes a product, puts more energy into it than you get out of it? I mean, corn is for eating, maybe for turning into whiskey or something, but it's certainly not for burning in your car.
Yeah, I agree with you, but our farm policy has always had the rather absurd philosophy of, you know, paying people not to grow corn or pay, you know, because it's all about controlling that supply-demand balance.
Well, but even so,
the farmers, you know, sold the idea that they could sell more corn if we turned it into fuel.
Right. But let's look at the practical impact of what's happened, certainly from a global greenhouse gas standpoint. If you go out to the Midwest, what you used to see is relatively equal amounts of fields between soybeans, and corn.
Yep.
And the soy had the great advantage of being a legume-like plant that would replenish the nitrogen in the soil, and you could rotate between the two. Now you go out to the Midwest, and you see almost exclusively wall-to-wall corn.
Right.
Well, the world still needs soybeans, so where did that production move to? Well, it moved all right. It moved to Brazil.
Right.
And what they did in Brazil is they cleared away the rainforest to plant soybeans. Oh, isn't that great? And so then you do the math on it, and what you find is that, it, according to some studies, it's something like 89 times worse for global greenhouse gas emissions than if you just left well enough alone.
Right.
And it's these sorts of crazy policies that only a politician could love that get foisted and thrown out there as somehow a solution to our problems when they're not. What we need to do, if we're serious about addressing both global warming and addressing our addiction to imported fossil fuels, what we need to do is dramatically increase the amount of electricity that we produce in this country from clean sources like nuclear power. And when you do that, you can make electricity to charge up batteries, and you can generate hydrogen at night through the electrolysis process. And there's been some wonderful advances made in electrolysis using nanotechnology that appear to approach 100% efficiency in splitting the molecules into their component hydrogen and oxygen. And if you can get close to 100% efficiency with today's nighttime electrical rates in places like Florida, which has an abundance of nuclear and coal-fired power, you could actually make hydrogen for use as a fuel in cars on a per energy equivalent of $2 a gallon gasoline. Who wouldn't want that? And the tailpipe emissions are water, and you don't have to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, that, you know, some of which ends up going to fund Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's a win-win-win all around.
You know, another thing that I hear from people that resist nuclear is they say to me that, well, nuclear is just about electricity. Don't give us the, it's going to reduce our oil consumption if we use nuclear, because we don't burn any oil in nuclear plants. But I'm a sailor. My experience, of course, was on ships. And it seems to me that all the nuclear-powered ships in the Navy are great examples of nuclear displacing oil. Now, you're from Southern California, right?
Absolutely. We probably have about 20 reactors at any given time down in the harbor in San Diego that most Californians seem blissfully ignorant of, and of course they should be, because there's never a problem on board those ships. They seem to be quite content to tootle along on the high seas for decades,
right,
without a problem, without burning any oil. So, you know, look, energy is energy, and you know, to a certain degree, it would make sense that if you want electricity, you should be maximizing the sorts of things that make electricity with little to no pollution. If you want to drive somewhere, it makes sense, at least now, to use liquid fossil fuels, because those are pretty efficient in internal combustion engines. You certainly shouldn't burn that stuff, though, to make electricity, because that doesn't make any sense. If you have something that moves, fine, go ahead and power it with diesel or gasoline or liquefied natural gas. But if you have something that doesn't have to move, like a power plant, don't use those fuels in those sorts of power plants. Using natural gas to turn turbines, I believe, is a waste of a valuable substance that should be used to make fertilizers, other sorts of you know, plastic products, as well as could be used to power vehicles. And to the degree that you're willing to explore more of the hydrogen economy, the hydrogen economy only makes sense from an environmental standpoint and from an economic standpoint if that power is made, if the hydrogen is made from something like nuclear power or hydro. Most hydrogen today, of course, unfortunately, comes from stripping it out of natural gas. And so then you still have the CO2 emissions as the result of that.
Yeah, where I was going with that was, I believe that, and I think that Los Angeles is north of your district, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the Port of Los Angeles has done some studies and realized that the pollution coming from the commercial ships coming in and out of
port
is a very, you know, significant portion of their, you know, emissions problem. because ships tend to burn very dirty fuels.
Right, right. And the challenge with that is because they're subject to international law and to federal regulations, there's been little the state can do. I mean, if we wanted to send some state-financed tugboat out and capture the freighter and bring it in using cleaner fuels, we could certainly do that. But the bottom line is, because it's regulated internationally and it's under federal law, we can't do anything locally to reduce those emissions. I understand there's been some rulings that have or agreements internationally that have forced these freighters to go to low sulfur fuel, which will significantly improve our air quality problem, but still not clean it up as much as we should. And of course, the bad thing for Los Angeles and for Long Beach is that that port, the biggest on the West Coast, is serving not just California, but a significant amount of the United States. There are goods that show up in that port in Los Angeles that will be put on a train and end up in New York a few days later. And so what you have then is the entire Los Angeles air basin, which includes my district, is suffering from the increased pollution caused by this huge amount of international trade that comes through that port region. And to the degree that we can come up with solutions to do anything to electrify ships, to have alternative fuels that are far cleaner, it certainly would be appreciated by the roughly 15 million people that live in that area.
I just think we ought to put reactors on them.
Well, there you go.
You know, commercial nuclear shipping, it's a great thing. But hey, I really have enjoyed this conversation, Chuck. I wish you have better luck. Did you ever run into a guy named Tom McClintock?
Oh yes. Well, he's running for Congress now in Northern California.
Okay.
Tom is a wonderful state senator. I've backed him in his various political enterprises, and he's helped me out a bit. And he's pro-nuclear as well.
Oh, yeah. He actually gave me a couple of articles back in 2000, 2001 that I have published on my website, because he's been fighting this fight for a while, but unfortunately still having all the challenges. I just hope that that more people start really thinking and questioning, because there's an awful lot of people in California who are very, very bright and who have a questioning attitude. If you didn't have that, you wouldn't have the Googles and the Apples and the Yahoos out there. So I hope that you have better luck in making contact with them.
Well, and unfortunately, I think it's going to take a bit of a crisis to get people to note. And
well, you may be having that coming up, like you said.
I believe it's inevitable. I think we're going to see it, and it's going to be driven by higher natural gas costs, and the voters of this state are going to demand some answers, and I think some politicians are going to lose their jobs over it.
Yeah. One more question I had for you. You know, one of the utilities that you mentioned, you said some of the utilities out there kind of play the green cards and hold themselves up as examples, and one of them in particular is Sacramento Municipal Power District, or Sacramento Municipal Utility District, SMUD.
Yes.
You know, I read all kinds of stuff about how, you know, SMUD, they decommissioned their reactor and now they're doing wind power and solar. Do you know what their current generation base is?
I don't. I would imagine it's largely natural gas-based. I also know that there was a recent article about the ridiculously tiny solar farm that they put out at the old Rancho Seco nuclear reactor.
It's a great photo up, though.
You know, yeah, look at us. And it's, as I recall, you know, making just a minuscule fraction of what the power that used to be made there. I think it's less than 1/100th of the power that was made at that nuclear power plant.
Yeah, it's SMUD is more than 60% natural gas. Still has somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% coal, that they're buying from other places, their wind and solar together is less than 3%.
Well, then, unfortunately, the consumers in the Sacramento area are unfortunately going to be looking at some pretty significant costs here in the near future. Not only is the natural gas prices spike, but also as the teeth begin to bite as far as the requirement to increase your renewable portfolio from 10 to 20%. If they're not making that, there are penalties that kick in. And, of course, those penalties end up getting paid by the ratepayers. So, it all comes back to the poor ratepayer who ends up paying for the bad decisions made by the politicians.
Yep, they need better leadership. And people like you and my friend Jill Buck out there are working hard at it. So
Jill's great. She's doing everything that she can in her area, and plus she has a very interesting program encouraging schools to go green. Anytime you have a government building compared to an individual consumer who's always looking for ways to save money, unfortunately a lot of government buildings, it's not your building, right? So you're not really paying attention to turning the lights off and doing what you can to prevent heat leakage. But she's got this great program that she's been working on to help schools become more energy efficient so that we can spend more money in the classroom rather than burning up energy. And that certainly makes a lot of sense, and she's to be commended for those efforts. She's also, as I recall, a former naval officer.
Yes, she is. Yeah, she's a bright lady, and I was found about her Go Green initiative when I was doing some searches and found her extolling the virtues of China's push towards nuclear power as a way to clean up their skies. So I thought that was that indicated to me that she was someone who thought really seriously about going green and not just following somebody else's dogma.
Exactly.
So, well, Chuck, thank you very much for your time, and good luck to you and your efforts out there.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we can continue to move the ball forward and eventually get some sense out here on the left coast.
One more thing before we go. Tell people how they can find out more about you and your proposed bills.
Well, there's a couple of sites. Of course, my personal website is chuckdevore.com. And then I have another site that's dedicated exclusively to energy and nuclear power issues, and that's powerforcalifornia.com. So between those two sites, you can pretty much figure out what I'm up to and what sort of success or failure we're enjoying.
All right. Take care, Chuck.
Thank you.
That almost makes me want to live in Southern California so I could vote for Chuck DeVore. I have something special for you tonight. A couple of months ago, I had Jeff Smith record a new song for Adams Atomic Engines and for sharing the message that atomic power is a better way to produce energy. Here is The Better Way by Jeff Smith.
If we all one day agree, if we all could see, if someone stood up right now, if we all could shout out loud, we're living on borrowed time, breathing filth from the sky. It could all be gone before we know. Could we say yes instead of no? There's a way, such a better way today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. There's so much this energy could do, and I know some feel really scared too. But if we look inside to the very core, we could see how this could bring so much more. It's so very safe, yes, time has shown how this brave power
has grown. We all put down our petty greed for the sake of the world. Let's all agree there's a way, such a better way. Today, today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. There's a way, such a better way. Today, today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Rising up from every land is a common cry from every common man. Marching forward to a day with energy from a better way. If we all one day agreed, if we all could see that the better way is right now, so everyone join in and sing out loud. There's a way, such a better way. Today, today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. There's a way, such a better way. Today, today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today, now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
Once again, that song was by Jeff Smith. He is available at thejeffsmith.com.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.